March 2nd, 2015 in Wellington, New Zealand. And we're going to be looking at what do the scriptures say about how a husband should treat his wife. It's very interesting. Many years ago, I was in Belgium, in Rotterdam, and one of the devotees said to me, "We hear a lot in the Hare Krishna movement about how women should treat their husbands, but we don't often hear people talking about how men should treat their wives." So we've done some research on the scripture, and I think that when people do talk about this in our movement, they don't talk about it just in the scripture. At least when I hear people, I hear devotees talking about how a man should treat his wife, generally they pull a lot from modern psychology and modern studies, which is fine. But I thought it would be very interesting to see, what does the Shastra say? What examples do we have in the Shastra? And then also look at, of course, Srila Prabhupada's instructions and the purports, and we looked at a few letters and conversations also. So we basically found 7 different points, and I'm sure there's more. So if any of you have some thoughts about more, I could add that for next time. Right. So I came up with several things. First is that the wife is treated as the better half of the husband, then as very dear to the husband, that the husband's job is to maintain her and to keep her from difficulty, that he should treat her with affection, without exploitation, and then as a partner in devotional service, and to engage her in the service of the Lord and the public. And I think especially those last two are sometimes very misunderstood. So we're going to look at each of these in some detail. So this first one, that the wife is the better half of the husband. So we have this quote from the 7th canto, chapter 2, text 54. "If unkind providence takes away my wife, who is half my body, why should he not take me also? What is the use of my living with half my body, bereaved by the loss of my wife? What shall I gain in this way?" This is a lament by a bird. But the principle of the husband and wife being half of the same body is something that was universally accepted in that culture. In Prabhupada's purport, in 1.7.45, he says, "A devoted wife who, according to revealed scripture, is the better half of her husband," not just half, but the better half. Right? And it's interesting because we have this kind of statement in our modern society, "Oh, the woman is the better half." But Srila Prabhupada is saying here, "Who, according to revealed scripture?" So according to the Shastra, the wife is considered the better half of the husband. And in Bhagavatam 3:14-19, "O respectful one, a wife is so helpful that she is called the better half of a man's body because of her sharing in all auspicious activities. A man can move without anxiety, entrusting all responsibilities to his wife." And Prabhupada says in that purport, "By Vedic injunction, a wife is accepted as the better half of a man's body because she is supposed to be responsible for discharging half of the duties of the husband." So half of the duties of the husband, and we'll discuss that in a minute. Then in 4:16-17, Prithu Maharaj, this was the prediction when he appeared, that he will treat his own wife as the other half of his body. And then Srila Prabhupada explains in detail, purport 4:26-17. He says, "Actually, the woman must always be protected by the husband. We always speak of the goddess of fortune as being placed on the chest of Narayana. In other words, the wife must remain embraced by her husband." Now, obviously, Prabhupada doesn't mean that literally. Could you imagine going through life always hugging your wife? So, he's talking, it's a little odd, he's talking about a mood here. "Thus she becomes beloved and well protected. Just as one saves his money and places it under his own personal protection, one should similarly protect his wife by his own personal supervision." And probably so many analogies here. "Just as intelligence is always within the heart, so a beloved chaste wife should always have her place on the chest of a good husband. This is the proper relationship between husband and wife. A wife is therefore called Ardhagnadi, or half of the body. One cannot remain with only one leg, one hand, or only one side of the body. He must have two sides." It would be a little awkward just to have one side of the body. "Similarly, according to nature's way, husband and wife should live together. In the lower species of life among birds and animals, it is seen that by nature's arrangement, the husband and wife live together. It is similarly ideal in human life for the husband and wife to live together. The home should be a place for devotional service." So here the wife is explained as half the body because she does half of the household duties or half of the duties of the husband. And to understand this, we had a talk at the women's ashram the other day about women's place in Vedic culture. And we find that it was very important for the woman to do half of the duties in three areas. And we'll get to bhakti near the end of this discussion, but certainly the husband and wife share in the activities of bhakti. It's said that whatever activities is done by one, the other gets 50%. As I said, we'll get to that a little later. And the husband and wife also share even in a material sense. It's like we look at the ashram. Of course, husband and wife are going to be in one of two ashrams. What are the two ashrams that where you're going to have husband and wife? Grihastha and vanaprastha. Of course, vanaprastha, husband and wife, could live separately. Prabhupada lived separately from his wife in the vanaprastha ashram. But certainly husband and wife could be together. So they'll be executing the duties of that ashram together. Just like we have examples in the vanaprastha ashram where the husband and wife do austerities in the forest together or they travel to the holy places together. And then in the grihastha ashram, we're going to get to this a little later, but the husband and wife can cook together and worship the deity together, take care of the children together. We do not find in the Vedic scriptures that the household duties are only for the woman. This is a very modern conception. And as we were explaining the other day at the ladies' ashram, this idea of this absolute separation between men and women's duties really came about with industrialization. Before that, it wasn't this idea. So the men and women help work together in the household. Of course, Krishna tells the gopis, you especially have to take care of the children. Obviously, it's the woman who's pregnant, the woman who's breastfeeding the children. So obviously, the woman has some more responsibility than the man just by biology. But half of his duties. And then what about Varna? So this is perhaps sometimes a controversial idea, even in a Hare Krishna movement. And I believe that the controversy comes again, because there's no living person who remembers pre-industrial life. And not very many of us who live in a non-industrialized society. So when industrialization happened, it moved career out of the home. That was the first thing that happened with industrialization. The first industry, I believe, the first industry to be industrialized was textiles. And the textile industry had been done in the home. Even today, if you go to non-industrialized parts of the world, you'll find textile making is done in the home. And it's not just done for the family. It's often done as a business. Like if you go to Swarup Ganj, right across the Jalangi from our property in Mayapur, you'll see it there. I was just there recently. I didn't see it as much. But you used to see everybody spinning and weaving in their home. And then they're selling the goods either right from their home or they sell to someone who sells then retail in a shop. And one of the main ways that women contributed economically was through textiles. And so women had to, all of a sudden, if they wanted to make an economic contribution to their family and to society, they had to go out of the home. I mean, it was the first time that almost everybody had to work out of the home. There's always been some people, you know, the people who traveled in ships as merchants or whatever, who worked out of the home. But to have, in general, that anybody who wanted to have a job would have to go out of the home, this was a very new thing in society. And as more and more jobs went out of the home and as people started to go to work, just like Chanakapandi, he says, a man's happy if he doesn't have to leave his home to work. He says, if he's not in debt, if he doesn't have to leave his home to go to work. So that was the standard, that you worked from home. As all the jobs left the home, all of a sudden women had to make a choice that they hadn't had to make before. And that was, what do I do? Do I work or do I take care of the home? And in those days, when people didn't practice contraception and abortion, it wasn't much of a choice. You know, if you were going to have 6 kids or 10 kids or 15 kids, you weren't going to be able to say, I'm going to choose career and home. You had to choose home. There really wasn't that much of an option, unless you had a lot of help from extended family. And then later on, as the home became industrialized, as industrialization came into the home became mechanized. You got your, you know, washing machine and your dryer and your blender and, you know, your microwave. And then people started using contraception and they had 2 or 3 children. Pretty soon the woman had nothing to do at home. She only had maybe, you know, 2 or 3 years of work to do at home, and that when the children were very small. And then that started the women's liberation movement where they said, wait a minute, we don't have anything to do anymore. We have no function in society anymore. And they said, this time we're going to choose career. So at the start of industrialization, women chose home over career, and later on, women chose career over home, which we've seen. When women chose home over career, there was a whole part of women's life was unfulfilled, a whole aspect of women's nature. And when women chose career over home, then basically the family fell apart in society. But in a non-industrialized society, women has career and home at the same time, just as man has career and home at the same time. And we find throughout the Shastra that it was very important that a husband and wife be of the same varna. Because sometimes people will say, oh, women have no varna. I recently actually heard one devotee say this. Women have no varna. But if women had no varna, there wouldn't be all this discussion in the Shastra that a Brahmin man marries a Brahmin woman, a Kshatriya man marries a Kshatriya woman. And it was considered very degrading if there was a mixed caste marriage, especially if the woman was from a higher caste. And it's not that if the men and women were different castes that the woman became the husband's varna with marriage. Like we have Ramaharshan Sutta, his mother was a Brahmana, his father was a Kshatriya. And he was considered a Brahmana, but he was considered Sutta. He was considered from a mixed caste. She didn't become a Kshatriya. Right? Or we have Nandamarj and Vasudev. Nandamarj and Vasudev have the same father, but Vasudev has a Kshatriya mother, and Nandamarj has a Vaishya mother. So Vasudev is considered a Kshatriya, and Nandamarj is considered a Vaishya. Interesting, isn't it? Yes. Now, this caste for the woman, the varna of the woman, was not by birth. Some people will say, well, the woman's varna was by her father. But then we're saying there's caste by birth for at least half the population, and there's nothing shastrically to support that. When Krishna says, chatur varna maya shristam guna karma vibhagasham, he says that varna is determined by qualities and work. And he never indicates that that applies only to males. There's no verse after that that says that varna is by janma for ladies. And Srila Prabhupada says that the varna of the husband and wife before marriage is considered by the horoscope. So if you were only looking at the girl's father, what need is there for a horoscope? So sometimes you find a girl who's born in a, just like with the men, sometimes a girl is born in a different family than her qualities. Like we have Devahuti, who married Kardana Muni, because she was of the same mentality. It's explained there that he wanted a woman of like disposition. So even though her parents were royalty, that wasn't her disposition. She was very happy to live in the forest. I mean, later, Kardana Muni thought, well, you were brought up in luxury, let me give you luxury. But her mood wasn't to be a ruler. She had the mood of a Brahmani. So the husband and the wife is half of the body of the husband because she shares in the husband's occupation. And this is one of the main reasons, I understand, why husband and wife should be of the same varna. Because if your career is going to be from your home, if the woman has a completely different career than the husband, it's going to be very difficult. And again, we see in the less developed world and in pre-industrial society, we still see it sometimes today, that the husband and wife are engaged together in the same occupation. And this way, the wife is literally half of the man's body. I mean, not literally, physically, but in terms of jobs. The husband and wife are sharing the varna activities. The husband and wife are sharing the ashram activities. And as we'll see later, the husband and wife are sharing the bhakti activities. So she really is doing half of the activities. And it wasn't that the man's sphere was out in work and the woman's sphere was in the home. This is something that really didn't even happen until like maybe 1910, 1920. It just wasn't something existing before that in human society. And of course, there had been the extended family. So it wasn't even just husband and wife, right? It was husband and wife and mother and father and auntie and uncle and cousins and so forth and so on. So in this sense, the husband sees that the wife is very valuable. She's a real partner, just like half your body is your partner. You know, your right hand is the partner of your left hand, not two different things. All right, the next thing we're going to look at is very dear to the husband. And there's a lot of places where the word priya, or dear, Srila Prabhupada translates that as, this means the wife. It won't say wife. It'll just say priya, or priyai, or priyam, or priyaha, depending on the declination and in the sentence. And, oh, this means the wife. He's there with the person who is dear to him. Oh, that means his wife. So we have several examples from 1741, from 1753 to 54, 4315, 9104, 91011, 91135, 10292, 119910. That's from a purport. where Srila Prabhupada mentions Bhrigu was born from the sacrificial fire. He was a great sage, and his very dear wife was Puloma. And these instances refer to the Lord, who sees his wife Sita Devi as very dear to him, also to Arjuna, who sees Draupadi as very dear to him. Someone. What do we mean by someone who's dear? What does this mean? So the word dear used to mean in English, I don't think it's used this way much anymore, something that was costly, something that was valuable. It had some value. So in modern psychology, they analyzed that love has three symptoms. So one symptom is that I find the other person fascinating. If, you know, I find them interesting. They're not boring. And you find when two people love each other, or even if you love your child or whatever, whatever you love, you'll find the loved person or object interesting. And the second is that that person is very dear. That person is very valuable. And there's a lot of people that I find fascinating, but I don't really care if I'm with them or not. It doesn't really matter to me. If I don't see them for a year, I don't even think about them. It doesn't matter. And then there are other people that if I don't have some regular time with them, some regular communication with them, it feels very empty. They're a valuable part of my life. I care about them. Right? The people that who, if they died, it matters. There becomes a hole in your life. Again, there's so many people who may fascinate me, but if they die, there's no effect on my life, whether they're there or not. So someone who's dear, they affect your life. And the third thing, if you're curious, is someone you can depend on. You feel this is a person who's there for me when I need them. Of course, we can't depend on any jiva like we can depend on Krishna. Ultimately, the dearmost person is Krishna. Krishna is the most fascinating, Krishna is the most important, and Krishna is the most dependable. There's no jiva who can be totally that for us, and if we think so, we will be very disappointed. But this concept that the wife matters to the husband, she's not just, oh, someone around, you know, someone who's cooking for me and cleaning the house, and if she's there or not, I just don't even care. And it's this aspect of being dear that makes us spend time with that person. This is one of the main ways that we tell whether or not somebody cares about us, if they want to be with us. Again, if it matters that we're there. And this will sometimes be a complaint between a husband and wife. The husband might say to the wife, or the wife might say, you never spend any time with me. You know, you don't do anything with me. I never see you. I was just talking with one devotee whose wife recently left him after many, many years, and he said, I can understand it was pretty hard for her because most of the year I was traveling, she never saw me. He said, I really wasn't even there. You know, he said, I gave her a beautiful house and a fancy car, but I wasn't there. So when, you know, if you're never there, then it shows that that person, the other person, you know, if I'm never there, how can I say you're dear to me if I never want to spend any time with you? So the wife is described like this as very dear, very valuable. And then Prabhupada talks a lot about, this is all from Srila Prabhupada's letters, maintaining the wife and keeping her from difficulty. And this, of course, comes into the idea of protection. So here's a letter to Hamsa Duda in August of 1967. Prabhupada said, you must carefully consider, however, your wife and child. Your first duty now as a householder is to provide nicely for your wife and child. Family life requires a certain amount of privacy and convenience, which may not always be available. So he's saying you have to make some effort to provide some privacy, some convenience. A letter to Bhardwaj in October 69. Prabhupada says, you are married. You must be responsible for the maintenance of your wife. As you are qualified, you can work as a musician, but you must maintain her nicely and help her to progress in Krishna consciousness. And to Suchandra in September 71, he says, your duty is to take charge of your wife so you can stick to your job and maintain your wife and family and give as far as possible to the Hamburg temple. You cannot be irresponsible to your wife and child. That is not allowed. If you can go with your wife to Munich to open a center there, certainly I have no objection. That is a different thing. But you cannot leave your wife to go to Munich. So we found that many times devotees in the Krishna consciousness movement thought that particularly the husband should be detached from the wife. And he should, you know, just let me go and do some service. And in fact, we had a time in ISKCON when there was a group of traveling book distributors in America, and they would go to the temples and they would steal the married men from the temples. And they would, They would say, you know, why do you need to be here taking care of your wife? Just forget about your wife. Just leave her here and just travel with us. I know one of my god sisters who told me her husband just said, oh, you're too much trouble. And he took her to India and left her at Radhakund and just walked away and said, you can stay here and chant Hare Krishna. So Prabhupada said, that's not allowed. You know, that you're supposed to be taking, the husband's supposed to take care of him. Again, as somebody very, very valuable who needs to be taken care of, who needs to make sure that she's maintained. And although the wife takes half the duties of the husband, still the husband has the primary duty for maintenance. Just like, although the husband and wife may share in the duties of childcare, the wife has the primary duty for the care of the children. So the husband is the one who has the primary responsibility to make sure that the wife is taken care of and the family is maintained. And that's his service. You know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about, we talked about this the other day with material and spiritual balance. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that, I see this home as your temple, Lord. It's your home. And I see that my wife and children are your servants, and it's my duty to take care of them. I mean, exactly like there's a temple here, and we have two people who live in the temple. So the temple president, town president's wife, they're supposed to be looking after those people as if they're their children. You know, taking care of them like that, just like the king and the queen, they look after the citizens like praja, like their children, and make sure that they have everything that they need, spiritually, socially, emotionally, physically, everything like that. So this is the mood, not in an ordinary way, not that we're thinking, okay, because I am the husband, therefore I have this upadhi, and therefore I have this duty in the world. That's all a bunch of illusion. But to think that as Krishna's servant, Krishna has given me this duty. Krishna's given me this jiva to look after. Exactly the way we would expect that in the temple, the devotees are going to be taken care of, like the ashrams here in Wellington. You have a ladies' ashram, you have a men's ashram, and somebody's in charge. And someone's looking after those people and taking care of them, again, as if they're a family for Krishna. These are the jivas that Krishna has given me to take care of. Or just like we feel here at the temple, any guest that comes to the temple, right? The guest is supposed to be treated as good as God. So a guest walks in the temple, right? We give them ample prasadam, we give them a welcome. At least, I hope we do that. Some temples are not so good at that. And we make sure that they're taken care of, right? That's just a guest. What to speak of the people who live in the temple? So our home should be like that. Our home should be like that. This is Krishna's temple. And we're taking care of each other. Of course, the wife should see the husband like that also. This is the jiva that I'm supposed to take care of. And the husband sees the wife. This is a jiva that I'm supposed to take care of. Sometimes we don't do this. I mean, really, sometimes we don't do this. I was once in a temple where the temple authorities were complaining about one of the pujaris. She'd been a pujari for 13 years at that time. And she had decided never to marry and just to be dependent on the society and work full-time for the society. And they told me she's been behaving a little strangely and we're thinking of asking her to leave. So I talked to her and I found out that she had had some surgery which affected her hormonally. And it would be some effect probably for about a year or two. And she hadn't communicated this to the all-male authorities. And I went back to them and I said, you know, somebody's given solid service for 13 years just because she has some physical disease that's also affecting her emotionally for a while her body balances again. I said, it doesn't mean immediately you throw her out on the street. And what is that? Again, this is also love. Love is I can depend on you. I know you're there for me, so you're valuable and you can depend on me. I'm going to be there for you. I think perhaps of all the things that frustrate us most and give us the most heartbreak in our human relations, it's this concept of being able to depend on somebody. Because we find in this world that people are not very dependable. And I think that this lack of being able to depend on people is increasing more and more and more with time. That as the age of Kali is progressing, our feeling that, you know, someone's going to be there for me becomes less and less true, that as soon as there's some difficulty. But this should be the mood of the husband and wife. You know, you can depend on me. I'm going to be there. I'm going to take care of you. But just as something official, can we say, well, as I'm doing it for Krishna, it's just going to be official. You know, okay, I'll take care of my wife, but officially, because it's just my service. It's just my service to Krishna, but without any attachment. But also to take care of the wife with affection.
So this is from the purport to 111.32. And this is talking about when Krishna returned to Dwarka and his queens would come to him with their sons. It says, although due to feminine shyness, there were many hindrances to embracing the dear husband, Lord Sri Krishna, the queens performed that act by seeing him, by putting him in the cores of their hearts, and by sending their sons to embrace him. Still, the act remained unfinished, and tears rolled down their cheeks despite all endeavors to check them. One indirectly embraces the husband by sending the son to embrace him because the son is developed as part of the mother's body. The embrace of the son is not exactly the embrace of husband and wife from the sexual point of view, but the embrace is satisfaction from the affectionate point of view. The embrace of the eyes is more effective in the conjugal relation, and thus, according to Srila Jiva Goswami, there is nothing wrong in such an exchange of feeling between husband and wife. So this great affection between the husband and the wife. Then we have from the purport to Bhagavad Gita 13.8.12. And this is a verse where Krishna is saying that somebody who wants to gain knowledge should be detached from wife and children. And Prabhupada says in the purport, as for detachment from children, wife, and home, it is not meant that one should have no feeling for these. These are natural objects of affection. But when they are not favorable to spiritual progress, then one should not be attached to them. So when one, just like Srila Prabhupada, when it came time for him to take vanaprastha, and he saw that his home was no longer conducive to spiritual life, then he gave up his attachment to home. This is a letter Prabhupada wrote to Janice Stambergs in 1966. He said, as she has become your life's companion, it is your duty to induce her peacefully in the matter of spiritual advancement of life. And I think this was very significant because many times we try to force people. And many times we think, okay, this is my husband, this is my wife, I should force them. And this particularly happens when the husband is more of a devotee than the wife, or the wife is more of a devotee than the husband. And you sometimes, you know, you counsel some couples where the husband is always trying to force Krishna consciousness on his wife, or the wife's always trying to force Krishna consciousness on her husband. But here Prabhupada is saying to deal with this affection. He's saying, induce her peacefully. This is your life's companion. You know, not you have to do this. And people get they get the opposite response when we try to force them. Right? Like most of us, we don't like to be forced. And some of us are extremely like that. Some of us have a nature that if somebody tells us to do something, we're going to run and do the opposite. Right? Yeah, there's always some people like that. And as soon as you say you have to do it, they'll run and do the opposite. I have a very good friend like that. Yeah. But none of us like to be forced. Even those of us who enjoy being cooperative and enjoy pleasing other people, still we don't want to be forced. We want to be treated with affection. We want our free will to be honored. This is a letter to Kulashekhar in 69. Prabhupada says, please offer my obeisances, my blessings to her. Please offer my blessings to her and try to behave with her as a very kind husband. She will be a very nice girl, helping you both materially and spiritually. She is a very nice girl. Prabhupada says twice in this letter, she's a very nice girl. But he says, try to behave with her as a very kind husband. So it's not that just because the husband is supposed to instruct the wife and guide the wife that he's going to do it, you know, with a whip and a chain. But to do it kindly, you're dealing with another living entity. I see that many times we're kinder to the cows, you know, than we are to each other. So we go to the cow, nice cow, nice cow. And then we go to the devotees and we yell at them and we insult them. And something like that. And especially, this tends to be a problem between a husband and wife. And, of course, women are also as guilty of this with the husbands. But tonight we're speaking from the husband's side, that it's particularly a male thing that, well, I'm supposed to be able to tell my wife what to do and she's just supposed to go do it. And I'm supposed to tell her what's right and she's just supposed to say, yes, sir, that's right. And I don't think you'd really want a wife like that. I haven't seen it, but I've heard that there was some movie like that where all the women in a town got replaced with robots. I haven't seen it. But I was told that the end of the movie was they weren't really happy with their robot wives. So, you know, people may think like that. They may think, well, you know, I really want a wife who's just like a machine. Like you have your computer, you have your phone, you have your car, and you tell it, okay, do this, and it does it. But you can't have a relationship with a machine. There's no relationship with the machine. It's just impossible.
Because the machine can't say no. That's why there's no relationship. What makes a relationship is the fact that it's voluntary. Not only do I find you fascinating, not only are you important to me, not only can, you know, will I take care of you, I may do that for my computer. I may find my computer fascinating, or my car, I may find my car or my computer fascinating. My car and my computer may be important to me and valuable to me. I might cry if it gets stolen or broken. And I may take care of it. My computer, my car can depend on me to change the oil on time, whatever. But there's no reciprocation. My car doesn't find me fascinating. My computer doesn't find me fascinating. Right? Does my car care if I even drive it or not? It doesn't care. You don't sit down in the driver's seat and the car says, oh, look at you. What? My car doesn't find me valuable. It doesn't say, you know, it really matters to me whether you drive me or not. You haven't sat in the driver's seat for so long. When you were here, you were just in the back seat and I missed you. It doesn't care. And I can't depend on my car to be there for me. It has no agency. It has no will. My car can't decide whether to be there for me or not. So that's not a relay. That's not satisfying. There's a certain kind of satisfying with being the, you know, I am the lord of this car, and it can do what I want. But it's not what we're really looking for in a relationship. So that a man might think that I would be very happy if I had a wife that was just like a paid servant. But in the end, that's not really what we want. And therefore, just dealing with the woman, you know, do this, do this, do this. And she's going to say yes. Now, sometimes she may say no. Sometimes she may argue with him. Rukmini argued with Krishna. And Krishna said, oh, that's very nice. This is our great pleasure. When we have some talks like this between the husband and wife. Mm-hmm. Or Mandodari, she argued seriously with Ravana. Although she's one of the five chaste ladies given in the Shastra. Of course, Draupadi also. She didn't just say to you, dear, I think it was just fine, dear, if you want to gamble me away to your enemies. I mean, I don't care. She didn't say like that. She didn't say, if Duryodhana wants to, you know, take me as his sex slave, you know, well, that's just fine with me, my dear husband. So to be kind to one. Then without exploitation, and this is a very important point, and perhaps one of the most important points, in general, in this world, our relationships are more or less exploited, depending on how... where we are in the modes of nature and depending on how advanced we are in bhakti. So if we're in the mode of ignorance, our relationships are almost completely exploitive. In the mode of ignorance, we really do see people as machines. We really do see people as there just to meet my needs. That's a very much mode of ignorance thing. It says in the mode of ignorance that one's understanding is just of one's work. It's very meager. Someone in the mode of ignorance, all they know is, you know, I go to my job, I do this job, I come home, I watch the football game, I drink some beer, and I, you know... that they don't really think about anything. In the mode of passion, you see, okay, I'm a man, this is a woman, I'm a this, I'm a that, this is a bear, this is a dog, this is a tree. And the mode of goodness, one sees everyone as a soul. And of course, in bhakti, one sees everyone as Krishna's servant, Jivara Swarupaya Krishna Nityadasha. So if you see everyone as Krishna's servant, how are they there for my exploitation? They're there for Krishna's pleasure. And if I see everyone as a soul, then I'm going to respect everyone as a soul, at least in the mode of passion. I have some idea that other living entities are alive and have some feelings. But in general, we tend to have an exploitive mentality. We tend to deal with other people thinking, what can I get from them? I will give them something to get something back from them. We'll have some sort of a business exchange. And this also definitely happens in marriage. You know, there's one very, very famous book about how husbands and wives should get along, how men and women should get along, and with a lot of good advice in it, certainly. But the author has a whole list of how men and women keep score. You know what we mean by keep score? Like you have a game. You have a football game, a basketball game, and there's a scoreboard. And this team has 20 points, and this team has 15 points, right? And then somebody wins. So this author was saying that in relationship, men and women are keeping score. And the woman is thinking, okay, the husband bought me flowers 1 point. You know? He gave me a bracelet, 5 points. Whatever, you know, and the man is thinking, oh, the woman had dinner ready for me when I got home. Okay, 10 points. You know? And it was saying that if we have too much that we're giving and not enough that we're getting, we become very disturbed. And we start to become disturbed. And wait a minute, I've given you 150 points and you've only given me 3 points. Kind of like you go to a shop and you say, wait a minute, you know, I just gave you $20, but you only gave me $5 worth of stuff. You still owe me $15. What's this? You got to give me some change. You got to give me some more stuff. So this sort of relationship, Krishna really condemns in the 10th canto, chapter 32. He says, these kind of relationships, he says, there's no friendship, there's no love, there's no happiness, and there's no religion in a mercantile relationship. He said, better to have no relationship than to have a mercantile relationship, where you're just thinking, what can I get out of this? But the truth is that until we're completely pure, there's going to be some element of mercantile dealings in all of our relationships. That's, you know, we can try to have as little as possible. As we advance, we'll naturally have as little as possible. But certainly we shouldn't have relationships in the mode of ignorance or even in the mode of passion. We should try to bring relationships at least to the mode of goodness. So here Srila Prabhupada, in the purport to Bhagavatam 4.9.12, he talks about the husband. He said he's not interested in bodily relationships with wife, children, home, bank balance, or in the distress and happiness which come from these things. This is a special advantage of being a devotee. So the devotee is not thinking, this relationship is for my enjoyment. This relationship is for mine. What am I getting out of it? And when we see, most of the time, not always, but most of the time, when relationships, we're talking here specifically about marriage, but this applies to any relationship, most of the time when relationships break up, it's because somebody or both people are feeling, I'm not getting anything out of this. Or I'm not getting as much out of it. Or I'm not getting what I bargained for. You know, when I signed the contract, right? Like I remember my parents paid for someone to make a deck in the backyard. And it never turned out right. So they took the guys to court. You know, we paid this money and we didn't get what we paid for. So people think like that. You know, I've given, I've sacrificed, and I thought when we got married it would be like this and like this and like this, and I didn't get what I paid for. Then in a letter to Hayagriva in 1968, Prabhupada says, the proposal that marriage will solve the question of lust is not practical. Neither the wife should be accepted as a machine for satisfying our lust. The marriage tie should be taken as very sacred. One who marries for subduing lust is mistaken, because lust cannot be satisfied simply by indulging in sense gratification. The real cure for our lust, of course, is falling in love with Krishna and turning that lust back into love. But the point here is especially that the wife should not be taken as a machine for satisfying our lust. So in general, the man should not see the wife as a machine, and the woman shouldn't see the husband as a machine for satisfying her lust either. But not for, in any way, not again, not the wife is not a machine who cooks for me, who gives me sexual gratification, who just there, you are wonderful. And then she's just something that exists simply to serve me. Some machine that exists for my service. But rather Prabhupada said this should be something that's very sacred, to see the woman as a person. And I believe, again, that this is the main source of grief in the marriage relationship. On either side, if anyone sees each other as this person is an object of my fulfillment, and, you know, it's not working right, I'm going to throw it away. I remember one time when I was quite sick and I was going regularly to a doctor, and I'm definitely getting better, but I wasn't well. And I said to the doctor, suppose you took, like, you know, a radio into the shop 30 times and it was still broken, what would you do? I was trying to say that he wasn't a very good doctor. And he said, well, you would throw it away. He said, well, that's not really applicable in this situation. So, you know, we tend to do that. If this person is not acting as a machine to meet my needs, I'm going to throw it away. I'm going to get a new one, you know, or I'm going to bang on it or something like that. Pound on the keyboard. Work. Do what I want you to do. But it's a relationship between two persons.
All right, so we've looked at the positive side even from a material perspective and no exploitation. Now we're going to look really at bhakti. And here we find that the wife is a partner in devotional service. We were talking about in the beginning how the wife is considered the better half of the husband because she does half of the husband's duties. So this is from Chaitanya Charitamrita Majjhalila 15.202-203. At Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's house, there is always a full stock of food. Whatever spinach, vegetables, fruit, and so on were required, he collected and brought back home. So in other words, he did the shopping. You know? So in some families, you find the husband does all the shopping, and some the wife, and some it's combination. But this concept, again, that the woman was in charge of the home, and the man was in charge of the work, was not there. This is even just 500 years ago in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's time. And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was doing the shopping. Now, as Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya personally began to help Satira Mata cook, that's his wife. She was very experienced and she knew how to cook nicely. So she was the experienced cook and he was the assistant. They were cooking together. He did the shopping and they were cooking together. This is from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Majjhalila 341. All the eatables were first offered by the wife of Advaita Acharya. Were first cooked by the wife of Dvaitacharya, then Srila Dvaitacharya personally offered everything to Lord Vishnu. So here again, they were cooperating. She was doing the cooking, he was doing the offering. I see some homes where the husband think, oh, my wife should do all of the cooking, all the deity, or anything that's, as soon as you walk in the doors of the house, except for maybe repairs, that's her business. But here we find that the husband and wife were working together. Now, this doesn't mean that every husband should cook, or every, you know, but the point is that there was some partnership. There was partnership in the occupation, there was partnership in the taking care of the household, and there was partnership in devotional service. Purport of Bhagavatam 4:26-17. This is the position of all materialistic men. They do not care for a married chaste wife. They take the wife only as an instrument for sense enjoyment, not as a means for devotional service. To have unrestricted sex life, the karmis work very hard. They have concluded that the best course is to have sex with any woman and simply pay the price for her as though she were a mercantile commodity. Now, we could have put this in the don't be exploitive section, but I put it here because Prabhupada says that the wife is a means for devotional service. So this is the opposite of being exploited. The opposite of being exploited is my wife is a means for devotional service. Devotional service by serving her. This is my service to Krishna to take care of his jiva. Again, as much as someone comes to the temple, we think it's my service to Krishna to take care of this jiva. And also that the wife is being engaged in devotional service. Okay, this is from Bhagavatam 6:19-18. Between the husband and wife, one person is sufficient to execute this devotional service. Because of their good relationship, both of them will enjoy the result. Therefore, if the wife is unable to execute this process, the husband should carefully do so, and the faithful wife will share the result. So either way, this is actually in a section of the Bhagavatam about a devotional vrata done by the woman. So this is the process that Diti was doing. So this is a whole series of Diti worship and vows and mantras that the woman is doing. And then this verse is given that if only one of the couple can do it, the other shares the result. So if only the wife can do it, the husband shares the result. If only the husband can do it, the wife shares the result. Obviously, if both can do it together, then both are also benefited. Then this is a letter to Brahmananda in 1967. Bodily relations between the husband and wife is secondary. Primary factor is that both should help one another in the matter of advancement in Krishna consciousness. So this is ultimately, as devotees, the kind of sweet relationship we want between husband and wife. That we help each other with kindness, with affection, in Krishna service. That we're not there just because we have a bodily relation as husband and wife and just to take care of the house and make money and get our job done, but to really help each other fall in love with Krishna. Then to engage in the service of the Lord in the public. And I think that this is perhaps one of the most misunderstood areas. And if we really want to look at how the husband will become detached from the concept of my wife is an instrument for my enjoyment, we'd be looking at this particular aspect. Because, I must say, many devotees have this idea that the woman should just stay home and never leave the home, and the only business she has at home is serving her husband. And that's it.
But the problem with that is very dangerous for the man. If the man thinks, this jiva is here only as my servant, that's our whole problem, isn't it? I'm the lord of the world and everybody should just be serving me. It's not like that. Just like it will happen also with the guru, if the guru thinks these disciples are my servants. Or if the temple president thinks, you know, everyone in the temple, they're meant to serve me. No, you know, the devotees in the temple are meant to be engaged in service to Krishna. The disciples are meant to be engaged in service to Krishna. The wife is meant to, of course, also. The devotees in the temple will do some service to the temple authorities. The disciples do service for the guru. But the guru isn't thinking, these are mine. Right? So the husband also, he shouldn't be thinking, this wife is my property. As like she's some sort of a slave. Right, so here it's explained, Bhagavatam 7.14.11. And this is the section of the Bhagavatam that especially deals with the duties in the different varnas and ashrams. So here it says, even one's wife at home, with whom one is most intimately attached, should be offered for the reception of guests and people in general. This is a section from the purport. The idea of giving even one's wife to the service of the public is that one's intimate relationship with his wife, or one's excessive attachment for the wife, by which he thinks his wife to be his better half or to be identical with himself, must gradually be given up. As strongly suggested, the idea of ownership, even of one's family, must be abandoned. The dream of material life is the cause of bondage in the cycle of birth and death. Therefore, one should give up this dream. Consequently, in the human form of life, one's attachment for his wife should be given up as suggested herein. So how to give it up? By thinking this is not my wife. I mean, one should even think this is not my body. If one just thinks my wife is half of my body as mine, that has to be a problem. But nicely, Prabhupada says you're gradually given up. So generally, when people are first married, right, they're a little, how do you say? It's fine. It's completely, can you tell her that it's just totally fine that we don't expect children to be silent? Oh, now she's crying. Crying should be outside. Just talking. We don't expect silent children. So gradually given up. When you know, when you're, of course, nowadays people get married, I don't know, when they're 49 or something like that. But used to be people got married when they were somewhere around 20. And then you're a little nuts. Yes? Husband, man, woman. I mean, you are. Even Prabhupada talked about this with himself. He said, I was a young man, young wife. And he said, I neglected my studies. He was a third-year university student when he got married. He said, I neglected my studies because I was so attracted to my wife as a young married man. So that's expected. That's expected. But gradually, you don't have to, you don't have to take her out just for normal children's noises. If she's screaming, you have to take her out. But as long as she's not screaming, you have to. Just little noises. Yes, everybody's okay with little child noises? Otherwise, in a talk on grahastha life, if we can't tolerate little child noises, then it won't be. So how do you do this? Again, it's not out of a lack of affection. It's not that you don't become kind or you're not affectionate. But you say, my wife also can serve the public. And I've been, for quite some time, counseling one couple where this is the main source of friction between them. Where the wife is very competent. She's a very excellent preacher. She's a very, very fired up devotee, as much as the husband is. And she wants to work as his partner, but he wants her to work behind him. He says that you should do everything through me. You shouldn't do any service directly. And it's killing the whole relationship. So this concept that the wife is also meant to be offered in service. One should be happy. Oh, my wife is doing some service at the temple. My wife is doing some service and preaching. We have here from the purport to Chaitanya Charitamrita Majjhima Lila 15.264. If a person is not in Krishna consciousness and is bereft of spiritual power, he cannot protect his wife from the path of repeated birth and death. Consequently, such a person cannot be accepted as a husband. A wife should dedicate her life and everything to Krishna for further advancement in Krishna consciousness. If her husband abandons Krishna consciousness and she gives up her connection with him, she follows in the footsteps of the Dvijapatnis, the wives of the brahmanas who were engaged in performing sacrifices. The wife is not to be condemned for cutting off such a relationship. And this is quite an interesting stance. I mean, again, I will hear devotees say things like, well, the woman should just stay and serve her husband absolutely no matter what. But Prabhupada didn't take that mood. His mood was it's the duty of the husband to engage his wife in devotional activities. And she's not required to stay and be a wife of someone who's not doing that. Here's a letter to Mahapurna in March of 1968. And this was when Satsrupa, now Maharaj, was the husband of Jadarani. So Prabhupada wrote, "Jadarani has now become a nice preacher. I have a report from Satsrupa that she gives lectures very nicely. If we open a pavilion, I shall take Jadarani also at that time so she can deliver nice lectures. I shall probably be coming there in Montreal by the first week in June." So Srila Prabhupada was very happy that this husband was engaging his wife in giving lectures. It was something that pleased him. I don't know how many of you know Jadarani, but she's quite a scholar. So Prabhupada was very happy that the husband was engaging the wife like that. Here's a letter to Himavati in January 69. "Regarding your questions, the examinations to be given, the girls will also be able to take these in Krishna consciousness. There is no distinction between girls and boys. The girls may also become preachers if they are able." So Srila Prabhupada didn't want the husbands to say to, you know, their wife, "You should just stay home and cook, and I'm going to do all the preaching, and you're not going to do any preaching." And again, we run into this kind of mentality. This is letter Hamsa Duda in 1970. "All the wives of our students should be trained up for deity worship and cooking, and when possible, they should go on Sankirtan party with their husbands and others." So we have a growing trend in our movement, especially in India, that to not allow women to do deity worship. At least when Prabhupada was on the planet, the main authorities in deity worship were both women, Yamuna and Shilavati. And here Srila Prabhupada, "All the wives of our students should be trained for deity worship and cooking, and when possible, they should go on the Sankirtan party with their husbands and others." So Prabhupada really saw that the husband and wife should act as teams in Krishna consciousness, should act as partners in Krishna consciousness. This is to Bhavanandan, 72. "Our girls can be engaged for teaching as well as temple worship." So again, Srila Prabhupada saw that this was, that he wanted the men and women both to engage in Krishna consciousness. And this is, in fact, described as one of the duties of the husband, to engage his wife in religious activities. Otherwise, what is she going to do? Then she'll be engaged. What does she do instead? Then she'll just be talking about who's getting married and who's getting divorced and who's having a baby, and you know, and that's all, right? And what is the point of that? What is the point in coming to Krishna consciousness if all you're doing is just engaged like that? This is to Kulashekar in 69. "I'm very glad to learn that Vishakha is fully engaged in taking care of the deities." So Srila Prabhupada very much encouraged this. There was one time Prabhupada was talking about how the women in New Vrindavan could be doing things like cooking and cleaning and churning butter. But when Kirtananda took a bunch of women off of the Sankirtan party in the city and brought them out to the country to just churn butter, Prabhupada was very angry. And said, "No, send them back. I don't want the Sankirtan party." So we've looked here at different categories, that the wife is the better half of the husband, according to the Shastra, because she shares in half of his activities, very dear to the husband, very valuable, that to be maintained by the husband, to keep her from difficulty, make sure she's a hardship in her life. I didn't put the quote here, but there's a place where Prabhupada says that it's much easier for men to tolerate austerity than for women and children to do so. And that the husband should make sure that the wife doesn't have difficulty in life. To treat her with affection, not with harshness, without exploiting her, seeing her as another living being, as a partner in devotional service, not just a material relation, but a spiritual partner. And then the way that the man becomes detached from the wife specifically is to engage her in the service of the public and to engage her in the service of the Lord, not just his own service, not just to see, "Here's my servant," but rather, not "Here's my servant," but "Here's my service." "Here's my service." So yes, my wife will certainly serve me, but she's also my service to take care of her. You know, my children may serve me, certainly my children serve me, but they're also my service. They're my service to guide and to train and to engage in Krishna service. They're not simply around to take care of me and give me what I want. So I hope that this was enlightening and enlivening. We don't talk about this very often, do we? So questions, comments? We were going to have a question time about children now. We're going to switch topics. Was that our plan? Or whatever you want to ask questions about, it'll be fine. Yes, please.
I'm sure we can just ask questions about...
Sure, whatever.
There's a question in regards to education. Now,
To what?
Education.
Yes.
For children. We've got a little 2.5 ball of energy who loves being around people. We have a path across the road, and the wife took him into the kindy, and he got all ecstatic. And then each time we walk past, he's on, and you know, he wants to go into the kindy. We take him to a play centre, and mum's involved in that a couple of days a week. So he's pretty much counted down the days to which he can get in. Now, just across the road, we've got a real nice multicultural school where the white is pretty rare, so you know, quite mixed up. And so my wife was wanting to know that it's nice we can kind of, there's this whole homeschooling thing, which we have looked at, which, you know, does seem nice. Our concern though is that, first of all, a lot of work on the mum, and second of all, here's this dude who really loves being around other people. So we were kind of thinking it'd be good to kind of, there aren't any Hare Krishna schools here, so it'd be good to put him into that school where he can run around and be a kid and get that interaction, and then give him some Christian conscious stuff at home.
Or you could have homeschool at home and give him other places where he can have interaction with other kids outside of schooling. So whatever situation you choose, there's never going to be all positives in it or all negatives. Even if you find a Krishna conscious school, you will find some fault with it. I guarantee you. You know, I ran devotee schools. I was a teacher for 27 years, and out of that 19 of those years, I was the head of the school. And believe me, people find things to criticize. It doesn't matter what you do. And one person will criticize something, and someone else will praise that very same thing. I had one day when two parents of high school students came in to talk to me, and one of them said, you know, you're giving the kids too much homework, and an hour later someone came in and said, you're not giving the kids enough homework. So whatever situation that you have for your children, whatever you do for their education, there's always some sacrifices. There's not going to be, you know, some ideal situation. I mean, my own experience, and I'm very dedicated to schools. I've spent practically my whole prime of life working in devotee schools. But what I've seen is that the kids who are homeschooled, without a doubt, devotee kids, non-devotee kids, seem to have the best character. That's my practical experience. When it comes to character, when it comes to maturity, I very rarely see kids as nice as the homeschool kids. That's my experience all over the world, in any culture, in any whatever. Of course, you can have bad homeschools too. You can have homeschools where there's this homeschool in name only, and nobody ever teaches kids anything, and you know, the parents are really low class or whatever. You know. But certainly, it is a lot of work. I mean, there's no question about that. And then you have to. Anyway, you're not going to find a situation where you get everything. You're just not. And if you say, well, we really like this school, we're going to move our family over here to go, then you move your family, and you may have that thing to contend with. So each family has to decide, you know, what are the most important things for us? What are our priorities? And what are we willing to sacrifice for our priorities? And that's a very individual decision. Do keep in mind that in most non-devotee schools, just being a vegetarian is difficult. Just being a vegetarian is going to make you an object of ridicule. In most non-devotee schools, there are some exceptions. There are some non-devotee schools where a lot of the kids are vegetarians and where it's a very open atmosphere, but most are not like that. And if you just think that we're not this body, then you're going to be an object of ridicule also in many non-devotee schools. Yes?
How does a mother or father become qualified to homeschool their kids?
Well, contrary to most people's opinion, teaching at least basic things on the primary level is not really that hard. You know, there's some difficulty in managing a class of 35 kids of all different levels, and you're trying to teach them all the same thing, but it's really not that hard. And there's so many more people homeschooling today that the resources and the guidance for it are abundantly available.
And is the primary teacher, or could it be shared between both?
Oh, for sure. And there's also many parents who set up some sort of a cooperative with other parents. So they may set up where, especially as the kids get older, they may set up where one person's teaching, you know, science and like that. But you can even get things. Now, one thing my daughter-in-law is doing with one of her kids is she's doing a homeschool program over the internet, so that the mother is just more supervising it, and that kid likes it a lot more.
All the way through the education?
Well, she was teaching herself, and just in the last, the girl's 13, she's just started in the last maybe 6 months doing it, before she was teaching her directly. Frankly, anybody with a high school education could teach little kids reading, writing, and arithmetic. It's not that hard, and it's not that hard to learn how to be a good teacher of those things. Just frankly.
That means one parent has to be home all the time.
Not necessarily, because most of the time in school is totally wasted. There's only about 2, maximum 3 hours of real learning that takes place in a school day.
Padaji, on the subject of divorce, I was reading this morning from Prabhupada Seth, where his disciple, there was a letter that came from one of the disciples asking Prabhupada, Prabhupada, I want to divorce my wife.
Mm.
So Prabhupada, Prabhupada and said, you can do it. So the disciple, who was his present servant, got very disturbed. And so at the time of massaging, he said, Prabhupada, can I ask a question? He said, yeah. He said, how did you, in our society, divorce is not allowed. So why did you allow this disciple
yes.
to divorce? And Prabhupada obviously gave a wonderful explanation. And the explanation was very simply that, in this case, I was just saving my disciple, because even if I don't say yes, he will still go ahead and divorce. And in that case, he will commit a sin because he's disobeying the guru. But by allowing him, at least I'm saving him.
At least he hasn't committed a guru aparad.
Guru aparad. But leaving that aside, when it comes to divorce, then my question is, sometimes in life, relationship comes to a stage where it becomes very painful. And
that's true in almost all of our relationships.
And both of them are suffering in this space.
Yes.
So, in a case like that, I mean, it has happened to me a few times where people have approached me with that sort of situation and basically said, what should I do? And like it or not, I basically said, if you are not living together happily and peacefully, what's the point of living together? Might as well separate.
Hmm.
Now, we know that is not what our sastras and our
well, of course, the other answer is learn how to live together happily and peacefully.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But every relationship has some bumps in it. You know, even you might have some relationship with a person where there's very little bumps and very few bumps, but there's always some bumps. And it depends on the nature of the people. If the people are very fiery, there'll probably be bigger bumps. You know, I mean, I know one couple where the husband and wife said that they've never had an argument between them, but they argue a lot with their children.
I was going to take it one step further, Mataji, there.
Yeah.
So, in a relationship where you have this situation, and the parents are still trying to stay together, but the ones who are really suffering are the children. So, my question to you was, in situations like that, is it not better that they stay separately, but still care for the children?
That's not the research.
Not the research.
No. The research is that the children suffer much more when the parents separate. Unless we're talking about, you know, some criminal situation. There are certain situations where a child is better off away from one or both biological parents. You know, there are certain extreme situations where, but they're not, it's not that there, it's a good situation, it's the lesser of two evils sort of thing. It's still a very unfortunate situation. And the child is still adversely affected, but they could be affected more. You know, obviously if some parent is molesting them or beating them or whatever, you know, if there's something like that going on, then better for there to be separation. But otherwise, no, the research doesn't show that at all. What it was interesting, I was reading a study recently where when the husband and wife are together, because we all have differences. There's no two people exactly alike. Personality means we have differences and different opinions. And many times people come to me and complaining that their husband or wife doesn't see exactly eye to eye with how to raise the children. And I said, but that's actually Krishna's arrangement. That there isn't just a unified view on everything from both husband and wife. But this research was showing that when the husband and wife stay together, it's the parents who negotiate their differences. They have to work out their differences. The children don't have to work it out. The parents work it out. And as soon as the parents separate, the child has to work it out. The child has to work out, wait a minute, my father has this view on this, and my mother has this view. And it becomes this incredible burden on the child, and a very lonely burden on the child also. Another thing that often happens when the parents separate is they keep the negative parts of their relationship and get rid of the positive ones. So often when they separate, they're still fighting, they're still arguing, there's, you know, this and that going on. So that the research doesn't bear that out at all. And frankly, even if there's no children involved, most people, research shows that most married people are happier than most single people. I mean, unless we're talking about people who are renounced, who are generally, you know, genuinely renounced, and they're taking pleasure from Krishna in their heart, that single people are not as happy as married people. Now, interestingly, men who are in a unhappy marriage are healthier, live longer, and are happier than single men. The happiness of the marriage doesn't seem to be the factor. It's just if they're married, they're happier. Whereas women, if it's a very unhappy marriage, might be happier if they're single. But women seem to be more affected by unhappiness in the marriage than men are. We're not really sure why. But I think it's our responsibility as all of us who are devotees of Krishna, especially those of us who have some leadership role, whether a titled or a leadership role or not, is to try to teach people how to have happy relationships. And I mean, if being a spiritual person doesn't give you the key to having a happy relationship with other jivas that you live with, you know, it should at least give us that. And look, sometimes it's very difficult. Sometimes it's very difficult, especially when one of the persons has some serious problem or some real serious immaturity. I mean, you have some relationships where one of the partners is really like a 3-month-old baby in terms of their emotional maturity. And that can really be a big struggle. It's not such an easy thing. It seems that in modern society we've kind of lost the art as to how to get along with other people. But our main principle is that I'm not in this relationship to get happiness from the relationship, nor am I in this relationship to please the other person. I'm in this relationship to please Krishna, and I'm going to get my happiness from Krishna. Neither being single nor being married will make you happy. Neither having children nor not having children will make you happy. Neither being rich nor poor will make you happy. Only having a connection with Krishna will make you happy. There's just, you know, that's just the reality. Thinking I'm going to be happy if I get married, I'm going to be happy if I have children, I'm going to be happy if I'm rich, I'm going to be happy if I don't have children, I'm going to be happy if I don't get married, I'll be happy if I get divorced. It's all nonsense. Those decisions should be made by what will please Krishna the most and what will be the most favorable for my relationship with Krishna, because that's what's going to make me happy. And if I can see at this time in my life as a young person, you know, who's not able to just live as a renunciate, honestly, this is the situation I need to be in to serve Krishna. And I should treat my husband, treat my wife in such a way that Krishna will be happy. I can see I have a desire to have children. I should have children to make Krishna happy. Or even, you know, this is my duty to this society, even if you don't have a great desire to have children. This is my service to the Lord. And when we see like that, then there just really isn't that much difficulty. There really isn't, even in very difficult situations. In very difficult situations. I mean, divorce should be for criminal behavior. You have to have some. You have to have an exit door for criminality. You can't ask people to stay in a situation where there's abject criminal behavior going on.
I was explaining something to someone about that in the same tense. And the person turned around and said to me, "If I think of Krishna all the time, when am I going to think about myself?"
Yes, that's all of our problem, isn't it?
Because of the current society we've got at the moment, both men and women, they're focusing upon careers, and so when it comes time to having a family, and then what we've found is a lot of the ladies, they have a hard time kind of with the child room, for example. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, obviously someone has to go and earn some money, and because and then not all the time, but a lot of the time the lady might be looking after the children. But they'd much prefer to be actually going off and doing the career. But interestingly enough, sometimes they might actually want to be looking after the baby.
Right.
But then there's this so-called perception that they should be out there. So sometimes, there's two cases, sometimes they want to be at home, but then they think that everyone else thinks they should be going out there.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes they might be at home but not want to be at home. But whatever the case is, it seems that it's pretty hard.
It's very, very hard. I mean, what we really need to do, this is why I got, for a long time, I couldn't understand why was Srila Prabhupada connecting Varnashram with farm communities. Because, I mean, in Vedic times, there were also cities. It wasn't that there weren't any cities where there was Varnashram. But the problem is, in modern cities, careers are out of the home. And then you have to make this unnatural choice, and especially the woman needs to make this choice. But frankly, the man's also making this choice. The man also has to, when he's working, be out of the home all day. But in a natural society, career and home were next to each other. The women didn't have to make this kind of choice. My advice, especially to young girls growing up in the Hare Krishna movement, is find a way of earning a living that you can do at home. Like Sesha Prabhu's daughter just graduated from law school. I said, "What kind of law do you plan on practicing?" She said, "Immigration law." I said, "Why?" She said, "That's what my father does, and the benefit of it is you can work from home, you can set your own hours, you can go to India for a pilgrimage, you can take care of your kids at home, and you can still be a lawyer." So there are certain modern careers that are at the most at odds with women's biology. Do you know which career in modern society is most at odds with women's biology?
Doctor.
That's the second. The first is a college professor. To become a tenured college professor. Because by the time you finish your PhD, and then you have so many years without being on a tenure track, and then you're on the tenure track, and when you're on the tenure track, you have to publish. And by the time you're establishing your career, you're 35. Now, women's peak fertility is 18 to 20, men's is 20 to 22. And women's fertility falls off a cliff at 37, it falls off another cliff at 40. So being a tenure track professor means that, you know, you don't even think about having children until you're getting near the brink of one of your big fertility drop-offs. And then to keep your career, you have to, you know, put in all these hours. And then, yeah, the other one is medical doctor. But the modern medical doctor is trained to work in a way, both men and women, that are completely opposite to human biology. That makes a lot of sense, right? You know, like these doctors are working in America now, they have a law that the medical interns cannot work more than 80 hours a week. Is that natural for the human body?
No.
Here are the people who are supposed to be giving the health and instruction for the human bodies of everybody else. And until they passed that law, they were making the interns work 120 hours a week. And they're making them work 20-hour shifts. So you're going to the hospital and they're operating you in hour number 18. Ouch. And then we wonder why there's all these deaths and diseases caused by medical mistakes. I'm sure that has something to do with it. So the whole medical, the whole modern medical industry trains, the training they give the doctor is the antithesis of normal bodily, just even the normal biological rhythm of the body they're messing up. And it's a similar kind of thing where you have to go to school for so many years and you have to be an intern and you have to be a resident and so forth and so on. And by the time that the woman can have children, she's also much older. And then when she has her children, how is she going to practice? So those are the two careers. I mean, putting aside things which are physically very much at odds with women, like working on an oil rig in the middle of the North Atlantic or something like that. But putting aside that, or being a fire, you know, I don't even know if there's a gender-neutral term for firemen, because it's such a, I'm sure there is one, but it's such a physically rigorous job that very few women just even have, can pass the physical tests to do it. But as far as a career that's in harmony with the home, so to be a wife, a mother, and have a career, those two are the worst for women in modern society. But that's what I suggest that ladies do. They find some career that they can do from home, that they can keep themselves active in some way, because we have that as part of our nature. If you have guna, you have karma. To say that a woman has the guna of a Brahmin, a guna of a Kshatriya, the guna of a Vaishya, the guna of a Shudra, but she's not allowed to have any karma like that. That if you have qualities that you're not, that you don't have any outlet for, you're going to feel what? How are you going to feel?
Distress.
What else? You have all these qualities that want to be expressed and you don't have any means to express them.
Dry, uninspired.
Yeah. Dry, uninspired, frustrated. At the same time, we have needs for ashram. We have an urge to have children. We have an urge to have a relationship with our spouse. So those are also there, and those will also feel frustrated. So there should be a way to have both. And the solution is not what we're doing in modern society, you know, have long maternity leave and baby care places at work, and that's not really making it. You know, you still have the woman is coming home from work exhausted, and then she's got to cook the meal and take care of all these kids, and you know, then she thinks, well, I want a wife to greet me at the door with slippers and all. So it doesn't work. Yes.
You were speaking about fun.
Is it important to know what your varna is? No, it's useful. The whole reason of varna, I mean, if you think about it, varna is about your career, what you do for your livelihood. And how many careers are there? I don't know. Wild guess? 10,000? 100,000? I mean, how many different careers are there? I'm sure there's at least 100,000 different kinds of careers. So why are there four varnas? You're taking these, whatever the number is, I'm just pulling out of the sky, taking 100,000 careers, and you're saying, well, some of these are Brahmin careers, some of these are Kshatriya, some are Vaishya, some are Sudra. Some of them, of course, some modern careers would be outcast careers. You know, if you're a liquor shop owner, it's an outcast career. So why are they put into these different categories? Because we're supposed to offer our career in service, as Krishna says in the 18th chapter. Any person, by performance of his occupation, as a sacrifice to Vishnu, can become perfect. So otherwise you have to say, well, how do I do it? You know, I'm a librarian. How do I use that as a sacrifice for Vishnu? And, well, you know, I work in a canned company. How do I use that as a sacrifice? You'd have to have 100,000 instructions. So instead, they say all the occupations that are in this category, this is how you sacrifice for Krishna. All the occupations that are in this category, that's how you sacrifice for Krishna. And there's different dharmas. There's different rules. Well, it's actually fairly simple. So, what are you playing with? Are you playing with knowledge and ideas and truth? Are you playing with taking care of people, providing them with food and clothes and shelter and medicine? Are you looking after them? Are you generating wealth? Are you doing something that's generating wealth for society? Or looking after natural resources and animals and getting wealth from natural resources and animals directly or indirectly? Or are you contributing to the beauty and function of society? Are you taking care of beauty and function? It's going to be in one of those categories.
And is it what you do for work that counts as that? Like, my husband's an artist, but
Well, unfortunately, some people are not working according to, they're not making their income from their varna. But technically speaking, technically speaking, what you love and what you're good at and what your propensity should be your source of income. Technically speaking. That's the idea of varna, that what makes you feel alive should be also your source of income. It shouldn't just be your hobby. But there are three categories of work, Prabhupada said. Your ordinary activities, which is your varna and ashram. Emergency, which is whatever, on a temporary basis. And then your desired activities, which are more like your hobby. So a person, you know, you could have somebody who's a brahmana by varna but has a hobby of doing artwork. Or a hobby of working in their garden. A brahmana could have a garden and a cow, and that's their hobby, but they're not a vaishya. They're not generating wealth for the society. A vaishya is generating wealth, is actually the only person who's generating wealth for the whole society. Yes?
Well, you're talking about this whole thing is how the husband can look after the wife. One of the things is when a lady gets emotional for certain, whatever it might be, lots of different things.
She gets emotional just because she's a woman.
Yeah, I know. So for example, like let's go back to this whole thing of, I want to look after the baby or the family, but then our societies or devotees, they think that I should be going up and doing these.
But in general, women from somewhere around 12, 13 till somewhere around 50 had to go through emotions like this all the time. Mm-hmm. It's just what it is.
And
men don't do that. Men do not have a biochemical system that's putting them through different waves of emotional ups and downs. They just don't. I mean, it's not that men don't have any emotions, obviously. Men have emotions. And it's not that men don't have good days and bad days and whatever. But it's not the same. It's definitely not the same. You know, and I can say, having come out the other side of that, it's not the same. When you're on that, when you're in that thing, you're in that thing. And what I've concluded is that men also find that very fascinating about women. They find it fascinating that women are like, ah, and then, ah. Because even in the spiritual world, the gopis are doing this kind of thing. There's an anger with cause and an anger without cause. And Rupa Goswami is explaining all this, and this is almost entirely on the part of the women. You know, the gopis are getting angry at Krishna with cause, and they're getting angry at Krishna without cause. And it says Krishna sometimes gets slightly angry for a shadow of a cause. But it's mostly something that the women are doing. The women are the ones pouting, and they're the ones, you know, acting contrary to their real feelings, and they're doing all this, and it's fascinating. You know, so of course in this world, the men are fascinated by the women when they're up, and then when the women are down, they're like, now what do I do? Get me out of here, I can't deal with this. You know, so in this world, nothing is, just like the women are attracted by the men, by the fact that the man is steady, and the fact that he's strong, and then that he's not doing that. You know, that he's going to balance her when she's up and balance her when she's down. But, you know, you can't depend on a man all the time either. Hare Krishna, what'd you say? Sometimes you want to depend on your man and he ain't there for you. I want to depend on you.
Not now, I'm busy.
You know.
But I need you now. Sorry, I'm busy.
The man is supposed to bring some. I think the woman brings Vidya Vadu Jivana. The holy name is like the bride that brings life to knowledge. And Lord Chaitanya said, a house is not a home without the wife. A house without a woman is lifeless. It's usually, there's some exceptions, but usually it's the woman who comes in, let's put curtains over here. She brings life, and the man brings stability. Don't expect the woman to be stable like that. She can't. That's not the wealth she's bringing. That's not the contribution that she's making. Yeah, a woman can be steady in her service. She can be steady in her 16 rounds and Gayatri, and she can be steady in taking care of the children and steady in having meals cooked. But don't expect the woman to be emotionally steady. She can't. And it would be terribly boring if she was anyway.
It seems our role as the husband...
Don't take it so seriously. and be there and be stable, you know. I'm sorry, this is not very politically correct, but don't take it so seriously. Say, you know, children are also like that. That's one of the charms of children. It's one of the things we find charming about children, that, you know, the child will laugh about something and the next month they'll be crying about something and the next month they'll be laughing about something. And it's something that we enjoy, but something that's endearing about children. I don't think it's very important. We're not these bodies and we're not these minds. It's just something we're doing in this life, and we've done so many things in so many lives, it doesn't really matter. And let everybody just be who they are and become Krishna conscious who they are. But don't try to make women emotionally stable when they may be 53. And then you're finished with the whole business. And then you're just friends and you go to visit the temples together, not trying to enjoy the male and female energy so much anymore. And just be the stable person, you know, loving and caring and there, but don't go up and down with her, or you're going to go crazy. And if the lady wants someone to go up and down with her, find a woman friend that can go up and down with you. That's what the other lady friends are for. And they can go, do that with the other women. Well, you can do it a little bit with the men, but too much, it'll be like, oh, I have to fix this. You can't fix it. It's not fixable. That's something that you have. It's like, you know, one of the things I like about traveling with my grandkids when they're young is that they're so, you know, I mean, like my grandson Vikram, he hadn't been on a train in his life. We live on this little island in Hawaii where there's not even a highway. Seriously, it's not a highway. It's not a highway, it's not trains. I think, are there buses? I don't even know if I've seen buses. We have one mall, one small mall. He said, Grandma, I really want to go on a train. You know, we went on our first train. He's like, I'm on a train! It was fun. I mean, I'm not going to get in. I'm not going to go there, too. I'm going to go, yeah, I'm on a train! Because of. But it was fun. There was a freshness and a that was nice. So I just appreciate that. And you can just be, yeah, you know. You say, yeah, it's hard. It's hard. It's really... It's so hard for women nowadays. Really, really hard. Very, very, very difficult to be in a woman's body right now in the world. Really, really hard. You have to make all these choices you shouldn't be having to make.
On that subject, Mataji, can you please comment on one thing? When we were in India about a year back, we went to this village where Jagan Nivas, one of our young boy was getting married.
Uh-huh.
And in this village, he was telling me when he was growing up, that how we grew up, we don't even know, because one moment you were in one house and then you'd run into another.
Right. That's right.
Now, my question to you is, that extended family that used to
makes
be there,
such a difference.
Why then the women of today are so much away? They want their nuclear family, want to stay away from the, you know, the father-in-laws and mother-in-laws.
Well, this is Prabhu with everything. It's just like you could say, you know, the kings used to take care of the citizens, but now nobody wants kings anymore. Mm-hmm. And it used to be that the woman could see, my husband is like God to me. And now they're like, forget it, you're not going to be God to me. Used to be people, I mean, even when I was a kid, if the teacher said something, the parents accepted it.
Yes.
Not anymore. And this isn't true. Even you go to India, you go to China, you go to these very traditional cultures, people are arguing with the teachers. Why do people used to accept arranged marriages? They won't do it anymore. At least they want to meet the person for a half an hour before and be able to say no.
Yes.
You know? An absolutely arranged marriage, people don't like it. And why don't they want to be with the in-laws? People are becoming exploitive. The authorities are becoming exploitive. the king's exploited, so he made a democracy. What is democracy? Democracy isn't just about voting. Democracy is you weaken the power of government as much as you can and still make it a government. You have your executive branch, your legislative branch, your judicial branch, some people can be voted out of office. It was to make government weak. We've weakened the authority of husbands over wives. I mean, when I was growing up, a woman's property was owned by her husband. When I was a kid, it wasn't. I mean, I'm not that old. I mean, I know I look pretty old, but I'm not that old. It wasn't that long ago. And women used to not only take their husband's last name, they would be known by their husband's first name. You'd be known as Mrs. Charles Smith, not just Mrs. Smith. You know, women didn't have very many legal rights when I was a kid. But it got to the point the men weren't trustworthy anymore. I mean, parents don't have as much rights over their children as they used to. In every country of the world now, the state's going in and taking away children. That didn't used to happen so much. That was very rare. And frankly, you know, a lot of the people who are still living in extended families, one of the biggest complaints you get is about the in-laws. I hear it. I mean, when I travel in the world, people who are still living in extended families, the biggest complaints I get about the in-laws. That the in-laws are very cruel to the daughter-in-law, particularly, and often even to their son. Usually, it's the son living with the parents. Although, like with Sarah Bell Bhattacharya, it was his daughter and her husband living with him. So it wasn't always the son and his wife. So people don't want it anymore. You know, you're trying to be a devotee, and your father-in-law is showing your kids all kinds of garbage on television and just criticizing all the time. And it's really, really, really sad. I mean, my oldest sister married a man who was the oldest of 10 children from a very traditional Yemenite family. And the families, they each had their own house, but they were all living in the same neighborhood. You know, gradually some of the 10 children moved away. But we'd go visit his parents, and at least 5 of her children lived right in the neighborhood. And it was just what you're talking about. The children would just run from one house to the other, and that people would share cooking, and they would share childcare. And this is another reason that women didn't have to choose between career and home, because it wasn't all on the mother. You know, when the mother is just home with the baby all day, even if you want to be home with your baby, it's hard. You know, the only time you have another adult to speak to is when your husband comes home. You know, it's a very... I mean, frankly, one of the wonderful things I found about going to the temple every morning when I had children was that I got out of the house. And I had other adult company, you know. I went to Bhagavatam class, which usually was stimulating, even intellectually, not just spiritually. And I wasn't just home with babies. That no matter how much you want to be home with your babies, you know, we're not one-dimensional creatures. So if we can't, what we're starting to do in our Hare Krishna movement in some places is we're starting to build an extended family, not by blood, but by spiritual family. Of course, it's not quite the same as the blood relation. It isn't. You know, with a blood relation, you feel much more obliged to take care of people, and you feel much more obliged to help out. You know, when one of my kids is having a baby and they say, Mata, can you come and help us out? I'll change my whole schedule, and I wouldn't just do that for a friend. So there is a stronger relationship when it's a literal biological family. And I think sometimes in our devotee community we get disappointed because we think it's going to be quite like a family, and it's not. But we're trying to sort of imitate that to some extent and be family for each other and be there. People misuse their authority, and we're really in such a sad situation. I mean, everyone is suffering. Everyone is suffering, but I see that it's really hard for women. It's really, really hard for a woman to be a devotee, a wife and a mother, and take care of the other parts of her where she wants to, you know, make some contribution to the society and make some economic contribution. Very difficult to do all of those and peacefully, without stress. I mean, there's always some stress in the world, but without excessive stress, right? And I see, again, this is one of the main reasons Srila Prabhupada wanted to create farm communities and self-sufficient communities and communities of devotees working together. Because once we're living in the modern industrialized developed world, I mean, we may love that we have mobile phones and cars, but we're paying a price in the nature of society. I'm sure there's a way to do it with cities also. I'm sure in Dwarka and Hastinapur they could also do that. I think we should end. It's almost 9:15. It's getting kind of late. So I hope that this was some... we touched on some interesting things, and if we opened up more questions than we answered, that's not a bad thing. I don't think we can pretend that in one night we're going to go through everything on this very, very big topic, but just start exploring it and start talking about it and looking at things is hopefully valuable for everybody. If I've said anything that offended anybody, I apologize. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada, keep chatting.